Well, greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Law Hour's Editorial Review. The Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour's Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week here on Truth Radio Network, worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Editorial Review and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. And the Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events in the light of Bible prophecy, biblical law, and scriptural history. So stay tuned for tonight's special reports right after this message. Well, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Well, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper, like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, debt, and usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there is no difference in the value of gold and silver coin or clad coin and currency. That comes from the 1965 Act, and it's codified in Title 31, Section 5101 through 5112. And you know that's true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, did you know there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power between gold and paper? And there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on the use of that paper money versus gold. Well, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin in our Constitution for no good purpose. They knew, and they knew as a matter of law, that gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us in order for us to deal in and to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver away from us for no good reason either. Now, the politicians knew full well that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away their gold and silver coin, take away the people's right to own property and to destroy their property rights. And they did just that. It's called House Joint Resolution 192. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, our duties, our capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights. And that's because property is the legal foundation of all liberty. Well, let me teach you how to do just that. This is one of the basic lessons in my business school, which is now on compact disc for adult home school. Now, for more information about my private business school, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's free, free of charge. Call right now, the number, 417-273-4967. And my business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto that email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, we were talking about anti-Semitism in the law. Let's take a look at aid to Israel. This is an estimate by Thomas Stauffer. He's a consulting economist in Washington. For decades, his analysis of the Middle East scene have made him a frequent thorn in the side of the Israel lobby, an obvious anti-Semite. Now, for the first time in many years, Mr. Stauffer has tallied the total cost of the United States of its backing of Israel in its drawn-out, violent dispute with the Palestinians. And so far, he figures the bill adds up to more than twice the cost of the Vietnam War. And now Israel wants more. In a meeting at the White House late last month, Israeli officials made a pitch for $4 billion in additional military aid to defray the rising costs of dealing with the Intifada and the suicide bombing. They also asked for more than $8 billion in loan guarantees to help the country's recession-bound economy. Now, considering Israel's deep economic troubles, Stauffer doubts that the Israel bonds covered by the loan guarantees will ever be repaid. So the bonds are likely to be structured so that they do not pay interest until they reach maturity. And if Stauffer is right, the United States would end up paying both principal and interest, perhaps 10 years out. Israel's request could be part of a supplemental spending bill that's likely to be passed early next year, perhaps wrapped in with the cost of the war with Iraq. Now, that's just real special, isn't it? That's one of these pork barrel kind of projects that goes on. And when they want to get something through, then they put in a rider on some other bill. You know, it could be for the campsite development in Yosemite National Park. And then they put a rider on that bill, aid to Israel, $8 billion. And of course, it gets passed, and nobody pays any attention to it. It's kind of a crazy system, but you know, that's what we want. It's democracy, isn't it? Now, Israel is the largest single recipient of U.S. foreign aid, and it's already due to get $2.04 billion in military assistance and $720 million in economic aid in fiscal 2003. It's been getting $3 billion a year for many years now. Adjusting the official aid to $2,001 in purchasing power, Israel has been given $240 billion since 1973. And Stauffer reckons that in addition, the U.S. has given Egypt $117 billion, Jordan $22 billion in foreign aid in return for signing peace treaties with Israel. Consequently, politically, if not administratively, those outlays are part of the total package of support for Israel. So argues Stauffer in a lecture on the total cost of U.S. Middle East policy commissioned by the U.S. Army War College for a recent conference at the University of Maine. These foreign aid costs are very well known, and many Americans would probably say that it's money well spent to support a beleaguered democracy of some strategic interest. But Stauffer wonders if Americans are aware of the full bill for supporting Israel, since some of these costs, if not hidden, are very little known. Now, one huge cost isn't very secret. It is the higher cost of oil and other economic damage to the United States after Israel-Arab wars. In 1973, for instance, Arab nations attacked Israel in an attempt to win back territory that Israel had conquered in the 1967 war. President Nixon resupplied Israel with U.S. arms, triggering the Arab oil embargo against the United States. Now, that shortfall in oil deliveries kicked off a steep recession, and the United States lost $420 billion in 2001 dollars of output as a result. And Stauffer calculates that a boost in oil prices cost another $450 billion on top of the $420 billion of lost productivity, all caused by U.S. foreign policy toward Israel and the Middle East. Now, at that time, America was afraid that the Arab nations might use their oil clout again, so the United States set up a strategic petroleum reserve that has since cost, conservatively, about $134 billion. Now, other U.S. help includes U.S. Jewish charities and organizations have remitted grants or bought Israel bonds worth $50 billion. Though private in origin, the money is a net drain on the United States economy, says Stauffer. The United States has already guaranteed $10 billion in commercial loans to Israel and $600 million in loans and housing loans. Now, Stauffer expects the U.S. Treasury to cover all of these expenses. The United States has given $2.5 billion to support Israel's Lavi fighter and Arrow missile project, Israel buys discounted serviceable excess U.S. military equipment. Stauffer says these discounts amount to several billion dollars over recent years. Israel uses roughly 40% of its $1.8 billion per year in military aid, ostensibly earmarked for purchase of U.S. weapons, to buy Israel-made hardware. It also has won the right to require the Defense Department or the U.S. defense contractors to buy Israeli-made equipment or subsystems, paying 50 to 60 cents on every defense dollar that the U.S. gives to Israel. U.S. help, financial and technical, has enabled Israel to become a major weapons supplier. Weapons make up almost half of Israel's manufactured exports. U.S. defense contractors often resent the Buy Israel requirements and the extra competition subsidized by United States taxpayers. U.S. policy and trade sanctions reduce U.S. exports to the Middle East by about $5 billion a year, costing 70,000 American jobs. Not requiring Israel to use its U.S. aid to buy American goods, as is usual in foreign aid recipients, costs another 125,000 jobs to Americans. Israel has blocked some major U.S. arms sales, such as the F-15 fighter aircraft to Saudi Arabia in the mid-1980s. That cost $40 billion over 10 years, said Stauffer. And Stauffer's list will be controversial. He's been assisted in his research by a number of mostly retired military or diplomatic officials who do not go public for fear of being labeled anti-Semitic if they criticize America's policies toward Israel. The fact that the Arabs are also Semitic never seems to enter anybody's mind, at least not the minds of the American public, having come from Shem along with many nations of Israel, not the Israelis who are the descendants of Esau, not Jacob. Their effort to try and regain the birthright that was stolen from them by Jacob has been the catalyst for most of the wars in the Middle East. They are the money changers of the world who finance both sides. Well, I estimated here, I drew up some numbers here. It looks like this totals about $1.5 trillion. Now, if you took $1.5 trillion and the size of Israel, you know, it's about 5,000 square miles, I estimated that there was about 5 million people in Israel, according to the encyclopedia, and it just happens that there's about 5 million acres. With the kind of money that we have spent on Israel over the past 30 years, we could have paid every one of those Jews in Israel $10,000 a year. Or we could have bought all of that real estate. How's that? Stand by, we'll be back with more right after. We're back. You're listening to the Law Hours Editorial Review. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. All of these editorial review programs are archived for your listening convenience on the internet at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Well, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, which was negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits, such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, George Bush Sr., back in 1992, and George Bush Jr. in 2000, told us that what Americans wanted was jobs, jobs, jobs. But that is not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognize that real wealth is not measured in land, cattle, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's measured in property, not jobs, jobs, jobs. There is no money in employment, and the money is in private business and sales. It's not in public business, and it's certainly not in employment or jobs, jobs, jobs. Now it's time that you cashed in on your real inheritance and learned how to collect those benefits of that old covenant contract, which is still in full force and effect, and to collect your benefits in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. That's called real property instead of trying to collect credit, debt, usury, inflation, and worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on my CD Home School for Adults, my business school, and while you're at it, order my free General Law CD package at the same time. Order that CD package first. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free. And you can call right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send me an email request for the General Law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Some time back, I reported this article. It was put out by Al Adask. Adask is on Truth Radio. I don't know what time, but you can go to the website and see. And Adask made this statement. Let me read it to you, and then I'm going to follow it up and show you that Adask was exactly correct. He said, according to Alex Jones, writing Patriot Act 2 destroys what is left of American liberty, in the May-June America's Bulletin, Patriot Act contains a host of provisions that will usher full-blown fascism into the United States. All of those fascist provisions are disturbing, but I find several to be especially dangerous to those in the Patriot community who have adopted the don't argue, admit all facts strategies for dealing with the courts. As I understand these strategies, a defendant admits all facts alleged by the plaintiff, complainant, and thereby strips the court of a controversy to adjudicate. Then, having essentially admitted or confessed their guilt as charged, the defendant posts some sort of homemade bond, which allegedly discharges whatever debt remains after pleading guilty, more or less, to the charges. The judge reportedly accepts the bond, and the defendant skips out of court, seemingly free from any adverse consequences from the original charge. Well, so far as I know, this confess-all-facts strategy was first advanced by Roger Elvick and has since been embraced by Jack Smith at Right Way Law and possibly Victoria Day and other Patriot researchers. Well, I don't question the competence or the motives of anyone who has advanced this confess-all-facts strategy, and the strategy may be brilliant, even inspired, and I may be simply too ignorant to fully understand and appreciate this confession strategy. Nevertheless, the idea that we can safely confess guilt to virtually any and all offenses alleged by the government, even if you can beat the rap with some sort of bond, has struck me as unwise and potentially hazardous since I first heard of that strategy. And reading Alex Jones' analysis of the Patriot Act, too, only heightens my concern that confessing guilt to any offense or crime may be extremely dangerous. According to Alex Jones, Section 802 of the Patriot Act states that any violation of federal or state law can result in the enemy combatant terrorist designation, and thus any crime is considered domestic terrorism. Thus it appears that if under the confession strategy you were so blithely or too blithely confess all facts and charges against you for writing a check on a closed bank account and then discharge the resulting conviction with a homemade bond, you might be able to walk out of the court as a seemingly free man. but you would have established on an official court record that you admitted to having committed an offense and or crime. That admission under Section 802 of Patriot Act 1 would seem to provide incontrovertible evidence that you confessed guilt and that you are, in fact, an enemy combatant and or domestic terrorist. Now, there was more to the article. In fact, it was another couple of pages, but that's the essential elements. Well, just the other day, a lady wrote me a letter and sent me a transcript. And in her letter, she said, my son was caught hauling 100 kilos of marijuana from Arizona to Michigan. And he got caught in Kansas, and he was arrested and jailed, and he went into court, and he made a confession. Here's the United States of America versus Lawrence Thomas Curtis. Case number is 03-40022-01RDR. And let me read this to you, because this guy actually carried this out. He went in and confessed in a confession. Here's the way it worked. It said, for the record and on the record, let the record show, comes now the defendant debtor, Lawrence Thomas Curtis, by and through secured party, Thomas Lawrence Curtis, EL, copyright sign, of his intent to appeal the final judgment of the district court entered on February 25th, 2004. I, Lawrence Thomas Curtis, EL, copyright, certify, and swears on one's unlimited commercial liability that the statements that I'm about to make are true, correct, not misleading to the best of my knowledge. On February 20th, 2004, I, Lawrence Thomas Curtis, EL, copyright, the secured party, was sentenced to prison for 78 months by Richard D. Rogers, DBA, Senior U.S. District Judge. Despite my every attempt to satisfy the court of my standing in law, for example, one who has unlimited liability and that of sovereign more, by every attempt, was challenged and was said to have been frivolous. I say these actions of imprisonment is a violation of my civil rights. Subsequently, these actions are causing my family and me much harm and hardship. During the course of the past 5 months, during or about the month of October, I, the secured party, have personally written Richard D. Rogers, Thomas Ledke, for example, Assistant U.S. District Attorney and appointed counsel of the debtor, Ms. Marilyn M. Truby. I furnished them with the following documents, for example, an affidavit of negative averment, which detailed the fact that the United States of America, or any other all-capital letter assemblage, was recognized to be a corporation, and an insolvent corporation at that, which has not the ability to sue or be sued. And I also enclosed a certified copy of a document titled Bill of Peace, explaining the fact that I am a sovereign American who comes in peace, and I recognized esquires of being people of foreign agencies. I informed them by way of affidavit if a foreign agent acted in legal capacity after being expressly informed by a sovereign American, they would be doing so in their own capacity and would be void of all judicial immunity, and also that would be a crime of treason. I also furnished all of the above with certified copies of my UCC-1 financing statement security agreement, which clearly states all of the rights of a sovereign man. I furnished notarized power of attorney papers, copyright notice, and also an affidavit of truth, which stated, I was not a federal citizen, but I am a sovereign al Morocco's. After submitting these documents, through the documents I asked if any who should want to rebut my action to do so by way of affidavit through the notary named on the documents, and to do so within 10 days, and no one did so. I then, through registered mail, sent a certified certificate of non-response, along with a notice of default and stipulation, As of yet, no one has responded or even acknowledged said document. No one, not even appointed counsel, ever responded with a negative or positive objection to the documents by way of telephone, facsimile, mail, or internet. No one ever said that the documents that I sent by way of registered mail were frivolous, only that they were gibberish and nonsensical, which neither of the two means frivolous. I, the secured party, attempted relief by writing to Chief Judge Donnell Reese of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, and I furnished copies of all documents and replies that I had received from the District Court of Kansas. I again was greeted with no relief from the judicial system. I was only told that they could be of no avail to me, because at this time I was said to have been a fugitive from justice. And again, I was never told that the documents that I sent were frivolous. Today I take full responsibility for my actions. I tried to work within the system which was created to protect my rights under the Constitution. I sought help through and by the people who work for the system and who could be of no avail. I fought for life, liberty, and justice for all. I notified the court, the U.S. attorney, and appointed counsel, accepting responsibility for my actions. And I told the same that I had unlimited commercial liability, which held me harmless against liability. Today, I am incarcerated and being held against my wishes. For example, kidnapped in Leavenworth Detention Center. This is a direct violation of the First Amendment. I've broken no laws that were in direct violation of the Constitution that were written to protect the sovereign American civil liberties. I have broken no laws that are in direct violation of any criminal federal drug laws. For example, there are none. For example, that falls under 21 U.S.C. Therefore, here and now, I object to Richard D. Rogers' order filed on February 25, 2004, sentencing me, the secured party, Lawrence Thomas Curtis-EL, copyright, to the term of imprisonment for 78 months and the 3 years supervised release. This case should be reviewed and overturned due to incorrect statutes and or codes in 21 U.S.C. is not a criminal code. 18 U.S.C. is. And the government is applying criminal sanctions to a civil law, which is a highly illegal maneuver. For the sake of argument, I, Lawrence Thomas Curtis-EL, copyright, also known as secured party, did accept for value and took full responsibility on July 2, 2003, the possession charge in violation of 21 U.S.C. 841A1, a civil code, not criminal, and I object to the allegations of absconding bond supervision. I gave the court's timely notice. I spoke with a pretrial officer in Detroit, Michigan, explaining my argument, and I was told by the officer that he would notify the probation office in Topeka, Kansas, of my standing, and also by my not reporting it may result in a warrant for my arrest. Now, I told him if such a warrant was brought to my attention, I would voluntarily go to the court to rectify the matter. I was then assured by the officer if he got notice of a warrant, he would personally telephone. The date of his phone call was the first Thursday in October. I was never notified of a warrant from anyone or served a copy of said warrant until after I was arrested in Detroit, Michigan by state police on January 9, 2004. No federal agents ever tried to serve a warrant or apprehend me by any means. I also object to the quantity of hemp plants being used to raise the illegal sentencing guidelines. The government did not establish by a preponderance of evidence the quantity of hemp. They went off of hearsay of an alleged delivery stated by myself, but then retracted on the record and was said to have been done under duress only after being coerced by the DEA agent. This is a direct violation of the Constitution of the United States of America. I also object to the prior arrest contained in paragraph 52 of the pre-sentencing report and the probation office suggestions of accuracy without any research of the following. I believe the justification of my sentence was done out of vindictiveness for my beliefs in the uniform commercial codes and my fight for freedom against the system. I believe the ruling was unconstitutional, and I should be compensated for the abuse that I've been taking. I believe the very Constitution that Richard D. Rogers swore to uphold is violated by violating my civil liberties by sentencing me to prison after I did not repent. Back for the closer, you're listening to the Editorial Review. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. Your support of Truth Radio and of our advertisers and sponsors is very important to us. So for more information about Truth Radio Network programming, please go to our website. It's truthradio.com. That's truthradio.com. And remember, the Truth Radio is a private volunteer organization. We're established as a private charitable trust for the purpose of exercising and defending free speech. Now, Truth Radio is not a 501c3 tax-exempt institution, and donations are not tax-deductible. If they were, we wouldn't be free to tell the truth. So we rely upon the support that we receive from our listening audience to help us pay for our satellite time, our internet, audio streaming, and overhead costs. So we thank you very much for your continued financial support. It's very important to keep us on the air. And we rely upon those donations. That helps us a great deal. We'd like to have the bills paid by the listening audience. It hasn't worked out that way, but anything that you can afford to send is a step in the right direction for us. And you can help by sending your donation to Truth Radio here at Post Office Box 344, Napomo, California, 93444. That's Truth Radio, P.O. Box 344, Napomo, N-I-P-O-M-O, California, 93444. The other day, Richard Palmquist sent me a sample of that radio that he's been advertising. He said, I'd like to give one of these radios to every listener, and, you know, as a thank you gift for a donation. Why don't you check this out and tell me what you think of it? So I did. I got that little radio. It's about the size of a box of cigarettes, maybe a little bit bigger. Fits comfortably in your shirt pocket. It's an AM/FM radio, and it really works well. Made in China, brought over here by his son. He bought a bunch of them in Hong Kong. And I asked him, well, what do you think the thing is worth? And he said, well, we have one talk show host that is promoting them for $40, but he said if we could get a $20 donation for each one of those radios, it would cover the cost of the radio, and it would give us a donation for the radio station. So I said, well, let me test that. Let me see what it is. Let me describe it. Palmquist hasn't described the radio yet. It's AM/FM, and it's got a little button on the top of it that you move. You slide to eight channels or eight frequencies of shortwave. It's digital. It has an earphone jack. It has a clock and an alarm on it. And I'm able to pick up places like Beijing, China, Havana, Cuba, London, England, and about Buenos Aires I got on there, probably 10 or 15 world capitals where they have English language broadcasts. So you flip it on to shortwave, and it's just as clear as a bell. It is a better radio than, do you remember the old radios we used to have when we were kids, you know, back in the 30s and 40s? We used to listen to the radio before we had TV. And we had one of those RCA console models that sat in our living room. We listened to the radio every night. You know, the programs, you know, like the FBI and Peace and War and Beulah and a whole host and plethora of other programs. Anyway, they had a shortwave band on there. And, you know, once in a while you could get stations from across the world and around the world, usually with a lot of static and a lot of breakup in it, you know. Not this little radio. It's digital. It is as clear as a bell. Once you turn the radio with the antenna toward wherever the signal is coming from, and I'm out here on my back porch, you can hear Havana, Cuba just as clear as if it was being broadcast from Mountain Home. And the same thing with Beijing, China. They had a program on there the other night talking about panda bears over there, and English language broadcast, obviously. Of course, they've got Chinese language broadcast, too, but, of course, we don't listen to those. So why don't you take him up on the offer? I'd suggest an offer of $20, as what we'd like to do is, like, public radio or public television. They offer a little gift, you know, like a McNeil Lair mug or a T-shirt or something like that, and that's what Richard has in mind here, to help us generate that $4,000 a month that he needs to keep Truth Radio on the air. It's well worth it. That's what I sent, was $20, and I think that it's a $20 toy if I ever saw one. All right, here's tonight's wise old saying. We're talking about this straw man program. Hang on. Business is business. Bull manure is bull manure. Don't get them mixed up. And I just covered this little story here from Hal Adask, number one. And then I gave you a second story here from a kid. He's 30 years old or so. He's hauling 100 kilos of marijuana. He gets caught over in Topeka, Kansas. He walks in and he confesses to all of this. Now, he's been to one of these Right Way Law, Rick Schramm, Jack Smith seminars, which is just pure, unadulterated bull manure, pure and simple. And he believed it, and he went in there and he used that kind of nonsense that the court called frivolous, and somebody else called gibberish. And I'm sure this young man bought into that, and he believed it. Just like Catholics believe that the sun, you know, revolved around the earth and that the earth is flat and that chicken gizzards are accurate predictors of the future. I mean, you know, these kinds of fictions have gone on for thousands of years and people get duped by them. I've been and you've been. Deception is pretty common. And the guy probably deserves to go to prison because he's in violation of the drug laws, and 78 months doesn't strike me as being too excessive for, 100 bricks or 100 kilos? Now, a kilo is 2 pounds. That is about 250 pounds of marijuana in his van. But can you see the nonsense that goes on under the guise of law? People believe this, and they buy and pay money for it, and then they go to jail, and then they write letters to me, and they say, gee, what can you do to get him out? And the answer is nothing. Nothing. He's condemned himself out of his own mouth. The Bible made an observation like that. A man came up to David and said, I killed Saul. And David said, out of your own mouth you've condemned yourself. A confession condemns you. That's why in law, the Fifth Amendment and judges and anybody in the know says there's three rules in pro se litigation. And even if you're going to hire a lawyer, the three basic rules are don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. From the time the kid got caught, he should have shut up. He had stood a better chance of success. But once you go in and confess, and this is what L. Adask is saying, and this is just some more nonsense that comes from Roger Elvick. This guy Elvick's been in prison 5 or 6 times. He sells this kind of fraud and makes a lot of money at it. He's been doing it for many years. Elvick is a con man. And he's a nice guy. I've met him a few times. Jack Smith and Rick Schramm, they're all nice guys. And all con men have to be nice guys or they couldn't sell the crap that they sell. Now, let me pass on one more piece of information to you. This concept of confession is actually called a defensive pleading on page 380 of Koffler Reppe on common law pleading. But it's being used off point and out of context. Let me give you an illustration. The defendant could accomplish this end by use of the procedural device known as a plea in confession and avoidance, which took either one of two forms. One, a plea by way of confession and avoidance in justification and excuse, or two, a plea by way of confession and avoidance in discharge. The difference being that the former assumes that no liability ever existed and the latter assumes that liability once existed but has ceased to exist because of the happening of some subsequent fact or event. And then it goes on to illustrate in trespass for assault and battery. The plea of self-defense assumes that the defendant was never liable in point of substantive law, whereas in debt for $500, the plea of payment presumes and assumes that a debt which once existed is now no longer extant, and because of the happening of some subsequent fact or event, to wit, payment. So pleas in confession and avoidance were terminated with a statement that the defendant stood ready to verify his facts. Now, I teach that in Lesson 2. This was one page out of Common Law Pleadings in Courtroom Strategy and Procedure. And so what these con artists do is they take a legitimate piece of law, like confession and avoidance, and then they extrapolate that into gibberish and frivolous nonsense called the Uniform Commercial Code. The common law is the exact opposite of the commercial code. The Uniform Commercial Code comes from the Roman law merchants, or from the merchants of the Hanseatic League of 1536 in Hamburg, Germany. And that's where the commercial code comes from. It's called trafficking in the Bible, and it's strictly prohibited. The Roman civil law is predicated upon the Uniform Commercial Code. I can't for the life of me understand why people want to practice this UCC and then claim that they've got common law rights. The UCC is a contract. It's the exact opposite to common law rights. And this young fella bought into this kind of nonsense. That's what the bottom line is. And as a result of that, he has absolutely no defense. Now, he didn't have a defense to start with when he got caught hauling drugs. Those drugs are prohibited both by the civil law state and by God Almighty himself. It's called witchcraft. It's the art of the apothecary. Both the United States of America and the civil law government and the government of God, the kingdom of heaven, the government of Israel, prohibits the use of apothecary and witchcraft, which is what drug use is. So you got both gods mad at you at the same time. You know, you're giving the finger to the United States and giving the finger to God Almighty at the same time. Make peace with one side or the other. That's my observation. Don't give the finger to both gods at the same time. We'll make peace with one side. All right, there's the signal. It says our time is up for the first hour. Now hang on, we'll be back with more news and views. Editorial opinion when we come back after this break. Get a beer, light a cigarette, get a cup of coffee, and hang on, we'll be right back.